If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
It isn't just about the grapes. It isn't just about the land. If you don't have good people that you're working with, you don't have any of that.
We're better now today with more friendly competition. The wine community bands together when anything happens. And in our universe, agriculturally, fires, whatever, we're there for each other. And I feel the farming community needs each other. And we need to compete with each other in a positive fashion. I think that's been good for building up Napa Valley.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 523. This week we feature Hervé Bernie Scott, founder of Terrazas de los Andes, Mendoza, Argentina. When it comes to growing wine at high altitudes, Mendoza, Argentina is pretty much the place to go. Hervé Bernie Scott is founder of Terrazas de los Andes and has vast experience in high altitude wine. I spoke with Hervé by phone at the end of December, and I was captivated by his entry into Argentinian wine. Best of all, I've tasted several of these wines. All I can say is find them as soon as you can. You can also hear Hervé on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term mountain. I'm on the phone today to Argentina, Mendoza specifically, and I'm on the phone with Hervé Bernie Scott, and he is the founder and estate director of Terrazas de los Andes. I always try and see if I can get that correct. Hervé, how are you today?
Very good, Ray. Thank you to call.
It's fascinating to be talking to somebody right now in Argentina, though we can do this all the time, and it's about 2-something in the afternoon for you, and very different time of year for you as well. We're in mid-December for this phone call, towards the end of December, so you're just a few months away from your harvest. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, indeed. The harvest should start in February for us. And currently, mid-December, and it's like, 35 degrees Celsius outside. We have a kind of heat wave. It's a warm December for us.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're in such a different area. Your particular, now we're going to talk about the altitude in a minute, but where you're at specifically, what is your altitude?
Where I am currently at the winery, we're at 980 meters. We are at 3,200 feet. A little more than 3,200 feet.
Okay, yeah, so you're at a pretty fair altitude, but we're going to talk more about altitude in just a minute. I think one of the most interesting things I find is that you are from France, living in Argentina, and you've been there for how many years now?
Now, for 31 years.
What led you to Argentina, specifically Mendoza, other than obviously wine?
Yes, strange things in life, you know. Looking back, I'm 57 now, and looking back of all these years, I wouldn't have bet on the fact that I would land in Argentina and have a life over there. But I'm from the center of France, from a little town called Sancerre, where we produce quite a famous Sauvignon Blanc and some Pinot Noir. And my family wasn't in the wine industry, but I emerged in that landscape of vineyards and friends with winery and things like that, and wanted to be a viticulturist at the beginning. This led me to do the agronomic engineer school, and also to add to that an enological degree. And in '88, I was ready, to see overseas, to see a little bit in the world what was going on. Before going back, at that time, I thought I would go back to my hometown. But it was a long time ago.
Well, you were saying before that you had been working in the vineyards when you were as young as 16. Was that just simply a job, or was that something that captured your interest?
Oh, no, it captured my interest always. I wanted to... I love nature. I mean, I'm a guy who wants to be outside. I'm a guy who loves vines, but also trees. At the time, I didn't know if I wouldn't be, like a forest manager or a tree looking for trees. I always like to be outside and in contact with nature, vegetation, and respect for it. But obviously, the fact that vineyards is so noble. My wine was a wine geek, absolutely, with a very nice cellar. And he dedicated me to that. And then I moved to on the side of the vineyard. And that's why, basically, I selected this these studies. And after, I wanted to see in the world, that it was 33 years ago, what was going on outside of my little town. And that's how I had a chance to find a job in Napa. Napa, I would say, in 88, 89, was somehow still a countryside place, you know, with some agriculture. It wasn't like so sophisticated as it became now. And I met fantastic people and worked over there for more than for 3 harvests together with Australia, because the company, the American company, owned also winery in Australia.
Hmm. An interesting start. And going from France to spending time in Napa, then going to Argentina. I know what you're doing is you're making wine, but had to be quite a bit of a different culture shock making wines in these different areas.
Oh, yes. But that's the beauty of it. Through the wines, I have to say that from Napa to Australia, I worked in Tasmania and New Zealand. After I came to Argentina, and I had the chance to vinify to the wine in 3 or 4 other countries. And the difference of culture is the best. Is the best because you meet other people, other sensitivity. You discover the culture. You get richer as a person, not only as a professional. And that's what wine give you. That's what the wine will give you if you're open to that. To me, it's the real magic around that job.
Sure, you sort of absorb it. It becomes part of you. All these different areas, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There is not only empathy, but there is admiration, understanding of their taste. Obviously, it starts with different type of grapes, different terroir, different wine expression, but also the food, also the way of living of the people, their conversation. It enriches you and makes you a little bit more part of that big world, and a little lesser in a silo of your own country. That's why I love it so much, and obviously these places usually are a very nice landscape, very nice area where you have vineyards, you're in contact with nature, which add even a layer more to this cultural enrichment.
Well, in your journey, you come to Mendoza, and of course, again, a very different place, especially when it comes to altitude. How did that journey begin once you were in Argentina?
By a huge surprise and then a sum-up of surprise, because I wasn't expecting that at all. I arrived in August 91 in Argentina, and I can tell you, before internet, before anyone traveling to Argentina, because it was a very recent democracy and there were practically no tourists, it was very difficult to know what Argentina was about. Hmm. And I only knew that it was a sunny area, a plug against the Andes for Mendoza. It was a big country, eating a lot of meat and having a good football player, but, not much than that. And when I landed in Mendoza, it was in the middle of the winter, a very cold winter, and I had only shorts and T-shirts in my suitcase.
Yikes.
They opened the door of the plane, and it was -5 outside.
Oh, no.
And from there, everything has been a surprise, a discovery, and a love affair, because it is so beautiful. Really, this mountain area is just gorgeous.
I think it's that's quite a shock to be able to find that out, especially in an area when you think of South America, you automatically think of warmth, and that must have been a bit of a disappointment.
It has been a disappointment. I would say no, it has been a surprise because it was sunny. We still have 330 days of sun per year. I landed in Mendoza, which is a desert. It rains, let's say, how many inches would that be? 7 inches per year in big storms, and nothing during weeks or months. Then it's a desert with a bush, a desert plugged against the mountain. And we fully rely on the water melt of the glacier to irrigate an oasis. And only 3% of the surface of Mendoza is cultivated. And speaking about Mendoza, it's a big province of practically one-third the size of France. And you can imagine this immense, this magnificent view of the Andes, of the desert, and so on, with some vineyards cultivated as oasis, thanks to the water of the Andes, and this sunny blue sky, particularly all the time. Even if it is cold in wintertime, you cannot be disappointed at all.
Sure. Stunning countryside. And as our listeners probably know, of course, we're talking the Southern Hemisphere, so we're looking at this is mid-December. Harvest for you will be coming up next year, somewhere around February, correct?
Yeah, February for the white, March for the red, let's say. Yes.
Of course, it's a different situation, and many winemakers will go back between the North and Southern Hemisphere. But have you been back to the Northern Hemisphere since you've lived there to do any harvests at all?
Yeah, indeed. I harvest at in Spain, where we have a winery called Numancia. I harvest over there. Also harvest in the U.S. In Domaine Chambon, California. I had the chance to harvest back in France, taking advantage of both hemispheres. You know, when it's winter time here in the South Hemisphere, it's summer time and harvest in the North. I have tried as much as possible to keep on having two harvests per year. Now it's a little more difficult, but I've tried, yes.
So you're working at a much higher altitude than many wineries, certainly here in the United States. Typically, where are your vineyards located roughly in terms of altitude?
In terms of altitude, our vineyards are all our vineyards. We have a beautiful set of more than 1,200 acres of vineyards, and they are all above 3,300 feet, all above 3,300 feet. I would say the majority of them are above 3,600 feet, and the highest, watch out, because this is quite impressive, is above 5,400 feet. Then we have a large array of elevation, because that's true that we start at 3,300 feet and we finish with the highest vineyard at 5,400 feet. But anyway, we are speaking about elevation. Above 3,300 feet, it's already very high in altitude. And the highest one I mentioned, 4,400 feet, it's the limit of the cultivation of the vine, I would say. Higher, it's impossible. We are specialists of mountain viticulture. We are mountain. We produce mountain wine. We claim to deliver the fresh taste of the mountain terroir.
It's amazing to think about grapes being that high, because I'm sure there's a lot of challenges. But what specifically at these higher altitudes, what kind of grapes are you growing?
We are growing, obviously, Chardonnay, we are growing Pinot Noir, we are growing Sauvignon Blanc, and also some Malbec. Because the Malbec, so well-renowned, saying first that the Malbec is not an exotic type of grapes. The Malbec is a French type of grapes, very renowned in Bordeaux before a disease called Phylloxera, who removed it from Bordeaux at the end of the 19th century. Then the Malbec has produced during centuries the best Bordeaux before getting removed for a disease issue. But before that, it travels the Atlantic and landed to Argentina, where it prospered and it gave this huge, that very nice vineyard that we have today. And this type of grape has the ability to adapt to different elevation. It doesn't like warm climate. Don't plant it at low elevation when it's warm in Argentina. Don't plant it, I would say, if you would be in the U.S., in the Central Valley, where it's very hot. Look for cold area. In our case, it's altitude. And then it will adapt to different layers of a cold climate, to cold, to high elevation. It's quite plastic in that sense, once you give it a cold environment to ripen.
That's unique and very interesting. And as an aside, I tried your Grand Malbec just the other day. I cannot compliment you enough on that. It was an absolutely exceptional wine.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's done with a blend of three of our best vineyards. Yes, that's quite something.
Yeah, it was quite wonderful. So I'm curious, though, about these altitudes and how you're growing in Argentina. Do you have some unique challenges you're dealing with in terms of the altitude or just in terms of your growing area?
Yes, altitude, mountain vineyards mean extreme conditions. Then one of the conditions that can occur are frost. I mean, spring frost, which unfortunately destroyed the production of the year, is something that we have a little bit every year. Unfortunately, this year, the 1st of November of this year, once we have already some nice green shoots, we had a massive spring frost in our case that removed practically 40% of our harvest.
Oh, wow.
Which means that we accept the loss because what's left is beautiful in terms of quality. But you have to cope with that. We also have, these big rainfalls, the summer rainfalls, and suddenly a small creek turned into a river. And I remember the first plantation we did in 94, to have seen it was 5 acres completely whipped out by a creek turning into a river and flooding the vineyard and the post and everything. That's the cost of learning, and that's also the cost of the quality and the style that we are looking for at Terrazas.
So when were these vineyards planted, roughly? How long ago?
We have most of our vineyards planted in a relatively new area, which is called the Yuko Valley. It's an altitude area that allows the industry, the wine industry of Argentina, to go at higher elevation than ever before. And we were, with Terrazas, the pioneer of that. And we started to plant in 94, the first vineyards, and we planted 10 vineyards along the 90s in this high elevation valley. Then today, these are very nice vineyards, 25, 26, 27 years old.
Now, we're saying that some of these vineyards are terraced. Is all of your harvesting hand-harvested, or how does that work?
In Argentina, because we used to have a good labor force, we hand-harvested practically everything. Now, there is a little scarcity of labor, but we are still like 80% hand-harvest and 20% machine-harvest. And the most precious vineyard, obviously, going into the Grand or the Parcelle in the best wines, are hand harvest still.
Well, and certainly many, many vineyards around the world are going to, when possible, to machine harvesting because it has, to the best of my knowledge, gotten more sophisticated, better in terms of its treatment of the grapes. Is that fair to say?
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think that we have to... We are living with our time, and what is the conditions that we have now? It's scarcity of agricultural labor. Then we have to know when we plant a vineyard that it will probably be machine harvest. With machine today, that harvesting with such a quality, you have entire berries; they don't break the skin. We can think about the future very qualitative, facilitating the harvest with machine. As you know, it's quite a tough job. Then we make it easier also by machine.
Sure. And, of course, you have to stay on top of the machine and keep it working all the time, which is its own challenge.
Yes.
Well, congratulations to you. I understand you have won the Green Personality of the Year from the Drinks Business Green Awards 2022. That's a very, very big deal, especially these days, a green personality to be able to be that much more focused on sustainability.
Yes, absolutely. It's an honor for the team, because he obviously realized that this is a teamwork and something that you obtain along many years of work. It starts with a conviction, and then doing things, being bold, being courageous. You are significant, and you deserve such a prize. But really, you know, we are living in a place like Mendoza, which is a desert, and I would say that it's a very fragile ecosystem. It's maybe the edge of life on Earth. Because it rains very little, because our soil are quite poor, not much organic matter, because it can be hot. Then you have to be not only respectful of nature, you have to be an ally of nature. You have to support everything that could leverage, that could boost the biodiversity, keep that fauna and flora from the desert mountain alive. Keep healthy and living soil with all the alimentary chain of the soil, with insects, with bacteria, with mushrooms, with worms, everything mineralizing the organic matter to feed with mineral back the vines and the cultivation. You have to take care, obviously, about the water. Every drop of water is a drop of gold. And we have to, you know, when I produce a bottle of wine, I'm going to be very provocative. But the most precious thing that we have in a bottle of wine here in our desert is the water that we have used to produce this bottle of wine. In our case, it's irrigation of the vineyards. And we have to irrigate the proper way, the lesser we can in terms of volume, and in the right amount to give the best quality and bring back value to the place where we produce these grapes, to share that value with the communities. Then it's green not because we want to be green at all as an image or at all cost. It's green because the place where we live cannot wait. We have to take care about nature, and we have to take care about the people.
I agree. That's a very good sentiment, and certainly you're proving it by working that way. You know, I am curious about the water. Obviously, you said you're in a desert, and there's got to be all kinds of challenges with that. How is your rainfall? You know, I'm sure you're quite aware that the West Coast here in the United States has been suffering from a drought for many, many years. How is the weather and water affecting you there, especially being in a desert?
Okay, this is the question, because we are suffering a lot about the climate change, the global warming, and you will understand very quickly. We usually, the way life is possible in this province, including Mendoza, plug against the Andes at the west of Argentina, was with snowfall during winter time that refeed glaciers that then snow melt during spring and summer to give water for the population and the cultivation. And we only have 3% of the surface of Mendoza cultivated. I mean, it's very little because it's what we have through the snowmelt of the glaciers. The Inca, then the Spanish and Italian immigrants, developed a network of channels to distribute that water from the rivers to the entrance of each property. But with the global warming, we have seen the glaciers withdrawing in a dramatic way. And today we have half of the water from the snowmelt that we used to have, for instance, 10 years ago. It's getting very fast. Then it's really time to save every drop of water through modern technique of irrigation like drip irrigation instead of furrow or surface irrigation that requests much more water, by measuring exactly the request of the vine, and you can give exactly the amount of the drop of water that needs the vine to grow and to give you the best quality. You know, it's time to move to scientific solutions to save the water, that we don't have anymore, by the way. That's the reality of the water in Mendoza.
It's a frightening thought to think about. You know, you're right. Every drop of water is golden, and sometimes we don't always take the care of it that we should. I'm curious, though, we're talking about climate change and what you plant. For this length of time you've been there, have you had to make any major shifts or changes in terms of what you are replanting?
Yes, climate change has shaped a lot of our decisions. First, we purchase properties each time higher in elevation. You know, 1,000 meters was really cold 30 years ago. Now, really cold is 13 to 14 100 meters, sorry, maybe in feet. 3,300 feet was really cold 20 years ago. Now we have to go to 4,500 feet. Then we purchased more properties at higher elevation where water was available. And now it's not possible anymore because there's no more water to distribute. And also we change our viticultural way to manage vineyards. For instance, the orientation of the rows to have less exposition, direct exposition of the leaves to the sun. When you orient in a certain way, you can avoid, you know, that big exposition and the fact that the vines, they eaten up. We also manage the soil in order to have a mulch. You know, we don't use any more herbicides since a long time, and this drop down temperature of the soil compared to fully naked soil. Type of grapes, we are studying different type of grapes, a little more resistant to the drought, and also rootstock that have more ability to suck water from the soil. They are type of material, rootstock, that are better than others. Then it's not one solution. There are many solutions, saving water and planting the proper type of grapes, the proper way to request less water. On the other hand,
it's really extending the science to more what was known years ago, isn't it? You're really diving much deeper into the soil itself and, as you said, the row direction, that sort of thing. It's really become much more of a better plan. Is that fair to say?
That's really fair to say. By having these constraints that look tough, you know, you don't have a lot of water, climate is getting warmer, things are tougher, we find a lot of opportunities. We found that by respecting, by fostering living soils, you know, with full of life, having a biodiversity in the rows, under the rows, in the vineyard, all this native vegetation that came back into the vineyards, again, not using anymore. We are fully organic. That's another point. All our 1,250 acres are fully organically farmed. And we are moving also to regenerative farming next year. All these constraints, I can tell you, make our wine better because we are more in tune with nature. We don't use chemicals. We listen to nature and we adapt to it. You can taste it in the wine. These are more genuine and, to my standpoint, really better wine, full of values also.
I agree. It does make a difference, especially to the consumer, to understand the work that you're going through to be able to deliver not only the best product, but the cleanest product, if you will, when it comes to any kind of chemicals in the background.
Yes, you're right. You speak about less intervention with chemicals. When you're adding less and less when you have a much more natural cultivation practices, there is something beautiful that pop up in your wine. It's the expression of the place, because you don't kill the natural flora with herbicide. You don't fertilize, you know, with a chemical product. You don't twist what the terroir, what the land, its climate, its soil should give you. And it's beautiful, because when you don't do that anymore, you have really something different, distinctive, that pop up in your wine and give it a true personality.
Well, you may have already answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there one central lesson, one mantra, one thing that you really think strongly of when it comes to making wine, the one most important thing to you, other than obviously making quality wine?
Yes. There's something very personal at that point of my life, probably. But to me, a wine has to be good, but also has to do good. And for me, it's as important the how you do the wine than the what you produce, you know. And I will explain a little bit. A wine does good means that it does good for nature, where it grows, where you grow the grape. It does good for your people cultivating the vineyard with conditions that are secured, safe, with good working condition, with a decent salary, with empathy. And also good for the communities around the winery, because you, and around the vineyard. You cannot be wealthy or successful and the surrounding is suffering. This is not what life is about. You cannot build a wall 1 meter higher every year because there is a huge gap with your community. Then you have to give back to the community, and that's why we produce wine. We produce wine to give value to the natural asset of a place, and with this value, we give back. We give back to the earth, we give back to our people, we give back to the community. And I think that if you see that it that way, it's good for the one who drinks the wine, because he drinks not only a good wine, but he drinks a wine full of values, and also it's good for the planet and the people, to have a sustainable activity, hopefully for many generations.
It's an excellent philosophy. Good for you. We've come to the point in the interview where I have my favorite question, and obviously you've been in this business for a good long time. You have, I'm sure, done plenty of media and interviews. Hervé, what is the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
That's a surprise. Well, the question I never been asked, I'd like to be asked. I can easily answer to the opposite, you know, the question I often be asked and I don't like to be asked. For me, something like, who is the most important person in the winery? Who is the most important talent or asset in your winery? Because usually you can think it's the founder or the winemaker that speaks out loud to the press or whatever, you know, these rock stars. And to me, the most important person in the winery is the guy, a supervisor or winemaker, but the winemaker that really works the field, that turn on the light in the morning and turn it off at night, getting sure that everything is precisely in place and running. This is the most important person.
It's funny to hear you say that, because I've heard more than one winemaker say that they're the ones in first and they're the last ones out. I think there's just something about that that passion, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hervé, most importantly for our listeners who'd like to learn about you and Terrazas de las Andes, best pronunciation I can give you.
It's www.terrazasdelosandes.com.
Hervé, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the phone with me today, and I'm glad you're having a bit of a heat wave there. We're certainly not here, so I wish you guys continued luck. So thank you for taking the time.
Hey, it was my pleasure, and thank you for your questions.
Learn more by visiting TerrazasDeLasAndes.com.
Thanks for listening to the Longest Running Wine Podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.